Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Brené Brown says, vulnerability is not knowing victory or defeat. It's understanding the necessity of both. It's engaging. It's being all in. Hello, welcome to Just Make the Thing, a podcast for people who want to start a thing and keep on making it. My name is Claire Tonti, and today I'm joined by author, artist, Peter Drew. Peter has just written a book called Poster Boy about his journey to be a street artist on the streets of Melbourne and Sydney and Adelaide and across Australia. His work is political and cultural. It deals with themes of racism and immigration and nationhood and identity. But more interesting to me, Peter's story is about his own search for himself, I guess, for identity, for what really matters in life, and an exploration of his childhood and what happened in his family. The book deals with anger and shame, and ultimately about how love really can bind it all together. My chat with Peter was so great. He popped into our house, into the Planet Broadcasting Studio to talk all about it, and I hope you get as much out of this chat as I did. Here he is, Peter Drew. Hello, Peter Drew.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. I wanted to ask you first about street art and particularly what it feels like to put up posters in the middle of the night.
Well, it's scary at first. It was just very addictive because, you know, if I'm in the studio painting acrylics on canvas for an exhibition that takes like 9 months to put together, with going out on the street, you don't have that wait time at all. You can have an idea that day and go, oh yeah, I can, or on the spot. It's so immediate. And then the very next day, people come into the city and they're seeing what you did. So that immediate communication with total strangers is pretty exhilarating.
Yeah. Have you ever been arrested doing it?
Yeah, a few times, but it's never – but getting arrested is actually pretty – boring.
Really?
Because it's a lot of just going to the police station, waiting around. It's just, that's half the punishment, really. It's just how boring it is.
Do you have to have you ever had a chase down? Like, do cops chase you? Or do you just kind of go, oh, yeah, I am painting art, sorry.
I have run away before, but it's, yeah, no, I think when you get caught by the police, it's, yeah, there's not much point in running off. It probably makes things worse, so yeah.
I think I had this idea of you in like a hoodie with a spray can just like running down the streets of Melbourne or something in the middle of the night.
These days it's less at night. I usually do it all during the day and wear sort of a high-vis vest and just sort of try to blend in as much as possible. I get much more done that way. But there was a good few years there when I just did all late at night and was as sneaky as possible.
What does it give you to do that, to put street art out there?
Well, I think a certain temperament of people are attracted to it. Like, I think I wanted to be sort of on the outside of things. I mean, I was painting and showing stuff in a gallery, and for some reason that was always kind of suspect to me, that art world. And even the art world is on the outside of things in a lot of ways, and I don't trust institutions or committees and that sort of stuff. And so just being that freedom of being on the street and you're sort of against the cityscape in a way, like you're in competition with these buildings, and it's just a very sort of addictive form of expression, because, you know, if you're out in the city, it's an intimidating place even during the day, all these people that are busy, these enormous expensive buildings. But if you're out late at night sticking up posters or doing graffiti, it's just a very, so it feels like a very natural, liberating thing, because public space, it should be a space where you can communicate freely. But the only people that can really do that, the only entities that can really do that, are big sort of advertisers. But suddenly, if you just change the rules and say, well, I've got a spray can or these posters, now I can express myself in this space, it's sort of that sort of flip of the way you see public space. It's just a terrific thing. And it's sort of, you know, I mean, I've got to be careful with talking about it because obviously, you know, I'm not for just total vandalism, but I just think there's room for using art in a good way in that sense.
Do you have street art artists that inspire your work or that you admire?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's more the whole phenomenon, like the whole community. I mean, there's even the stuff I really don't like, I still kind of like. I like the fact that it exists. Like really sort of ugly, destructive graffiti is kind of, I'm still happy that it's there in some ways. Because it's, and councils and sort of companies will try to do this. They go, oh, look at graffiti, that's cool and vibrant. If we just remove the criminal aspect and just have the vibrancy and the fun, like let's do that. And it doesn't work. You've got to have, I mean, because what attracts people to it, what attracts young people to it is this sense of I get to say what I want, and expression is more important than property. I mean, that's a dangerous line to cross, but that's essentially what graffiti does. It says expression is more important than property. And there's some truth to that, but it's not absolutely true. You know, I'm not going to go out there and start graffitiing the front of people's homes.
So you haven't put graffiti on the front of our house yet?
Not yet, no.
So what kind of kid were you then?
Oh, what sort of kid was I? I was adventurous. Like I was obsessed with rock climbing, like before I was able to do it. I liked climbing things and just sort of, and that comes into doing graffiti as well, as just climbing all over stuff. What sort of kid was I? I mean, pretty solitary in some ways. Like I wasn't super popular. I always had a small group of good friends, and I liked finding excuses to have adventures and going sort of out of bounds a lot. There was a lot of breaking the rules when I could, if it didn't sort of actually hurt anyone. Because, you know, I think as a kid you sort of start to quickly figure out, hang on a second, the world of adults isn't all to be taken seriously. They, you know, sometimes adults make up stupid rules and it's fun to break them and get away with that. And my favorite memories from childhood are all schemes of that sort. Of like, oh, look, we can go out of bounds and then we'll tell our friends about how we went out of bounds, and that now we've got a club which is about going out of bounds. So,
yeah, wasn't it a gang? Didn't you have a gang? What was that called?
So there was it's in the book. There's a gang called the Kamikaze Run Squad.
I love that name because I used to teach 5-6s. I could just see, yeah, totally cool name.
Yeah, definitely. Like the word kamikaze sounds great, and so the idea of the gang was to run out of bounds at school and just shout as loud as we could with our arms stretched out like we were a plane. Yeah, it's sort of addictive, fun thing to do because you're getting away with something and it's sort of bold-faced in the face of the rules. And we made a little map of where we sort of run out of bounds and we're recruiting people. But it became a problem because other people started doing it who weren't in our club, and the whole thing sort of got out of hand.
Yeah. Oh, and then it just became anarchy in the school for a bit.
Well, there was an assembly in which I think it was the deputy principal sort of said, look, this running and shouting and screaming around has to stop. And so we sort of said, okay, we have to call it. But my dad found out about it. He like found the little map that I made and told me off. But the reason he told me off was not really, like, he was upset that we were running out of bounds, but it was like, the reason it's in the book is because it's the word kamikaze. As a kid, I didn't really know what that meant. I thought, oh, it sounded cool, and I sort of had some inkling of what it was about. But my dad he used to dive on shipwrecks in the Solomon Islands and Japanese planes and Japanese ships and like for all the stuff from the Second World War. That's how I learned about who the kamikaze were. And so it's in the book because I remember learning there was some other boundary that I'd crossed, like the conceptual boundary of this word kamikaze didn't belong to me. Like it was, and it was something I didn't understand, that these pilots actually sacrificed themselves in order to attack the enemy. And that was sort of something which I was too young to be playing with.
Yeah.
And I thought that's got an interesting parallel to what I do now, because I find photographs from the archive and use them on poster projects.
Yeah, like Monga Khan.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, which I think is such an iconic image. I'll ask you about that more in a moment. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your dad first, because he plays quite a role in the book in Poster Boy. How's your relationship with him now?
Good. It's really good. And he didn't like everything about the book. Like, it was uncomfortable for him to read, and I knew it would be. But even that conversation that we had was one of the best conversations that we had. And I mean, in the book, I talk about a lot of personal things, especially about family, because I think it's a good parallel for the way we think and talk about nationhood. But I think that those relationships, family and sort of in national identity, can get just sort of blocked, and especially when shame comes into the mix. Mm.
And silence, I think that comes through so strongly, that you grew up in a kind of culture of don't say how you feel, don't really talk in
But you talk about some things, like you talk about some things a lot, but other things just do not get spoken about.
Like politics and big issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up in a house like that where we debated and discussed and got angry, but we only got angry about political issues and things that weren't so close to home.
And that becomes like the currency with which you sort of try to say how you're feeling, and you're not even really conscious of you're sort of using it as a conduit for things that are much closer to home.
Mm, and much more underlying. And I think Brené Brown, who I love, she does a TED talk on shame. She's brilliant. And she has actually a Netflix special out now. But she says that shame can't exist once you say its name and you talk specifically about what you feel shameful about. Suddenly that starts to fall away. It's when we keep it hidden and secret that it kind of festers and makes things really difficult.
Absolutely.
How do you think shame played a role in your family?
Well, it's difficult to say because it's still sort of uncomfortable, I guess. But I think that, I mean, a part of the book is about me discovering when I was sort of in my early 20s that my parents had sort of marital problems when I was very young, like before I could remember. And it kind of, they tried their very best to resolve it, but they didn't sort of forgive each other enough or in a way which they basically decided we're never going to talk about this.
Because your dad had an affair.
My dad had an affair, yeah. Well, my mum did also, but it was the fact that my dad tried to leave especially. I mean, that's obviously different to just having an affair. But they decided to never talk about it. And that in their minds was dealing with it.
I think that was how that generation deal with stuff, is you don't talk about it. You just move on. It'll be right.
Well, we're sort of encouraged these days to sort of share and maybe even overshare. So there's this conflict between the generations. But they just sort of put it aside and thought that would be best. And I can understand that. And I even appreciate that. I mean, it's better than other ways of dealing with it, for sure. But it sort of meant that because that wasn't exchanged, those emotions weren't exchanged, it sort of blocked everything else up. And I really try, and I think that was the underlying dynamic of my family. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that reminds me of the way we think and talk about Australian identity. Like there are these two bigger problems that we sort of, we aren't prepared to face, and so we sort of avoid them.
Yeah. What do you mean? What do you think to you are those big issues in Australia?
Well, I think all nations have secrets or crimes or things that contradict the values that we uphold, like the way Australia was established as a colony, and also the White Australia policy is another example of that. They're sort of traumatic events that are too difficult to face or too difficult to reconcile with the story we tell ourselves about who we are. Mm. And it's kind of how do you face things that are that big? It becomes, you sort of have to rely on big old ideas that are sort of that border on spirituality, really, when you start talking about redemption and atonement.
And forgiveness.
I mean, these
reconciliation.
Exactly. Yeah. They're ideas that, I don't know, in order for them to work, you need to sort of practice them as a culture. They need to be embedded in ceremony and in culture in general. And so it's not as simple as a prime minister standing up in parliament and saying, I'm sorry. Like that's that. I mean, great as that is, it's sort of, it needs to be in sort of embedded in who we are. And that's the role of artists to try to imagine ways of us doing that, because there's no playbook for a nation to heal itself. So we all have to actually apply our imaginations to how we can do it.
Yeah, I do really think your work embodies that. I know that idea of creating folklore, which is what you did with Monga Khan. I guess for people who don't know, the White Australia policy, in a nutshell, I guess was a policy to try and keep Australia white, basically, and keep out immigrants from other nationalities, really, that weren't, I guess, Anglo-Saxon or European. Would that be a fair kind of summary?
Absolutely. The strange thing about it is the way it functioned was with a dictation test. So I found Monga Khan's image in the National Archive because he had his photograph taken for an exemption to the dictation test. So Monga Khan and thousands of people like him were living in Australia, and if they wanted to travel outside of Australia, they needed an exemption to the White Australia policy in order to get back into Australia.
Wow.
So Monga Khan wanted to go back to India and visit his family. So he applied for an exemption. And for that exemption, he had a photograph taken. And because ID photos at the time were taken by portrait photographers, all these images in the archive are just beautiful photographs. And that became the basis to my poster project. But I think what's interesting about one of the things that's interesting about the White Australia policy and the dictation test, they didn't just sort of go, oh, yeah, you're not white. We've got like a color card here. Your skin's got too much pigment in it. There was still this element of shame in what they were doing, because they didn't do it that way. They did it via a dictation test, via language. They said, oh, you can't complete this language test. We're going to exclude you from the country. But if they just said they did happen to pass the test, there are documents, there's tons of examples in the archive of the people who applied the test saying, oh, he passed it in English, so we gave it to him again in another language.
Oh, my goodness.
So they even they were ashamed of what they were doing, and so they created this little bureaucratic mechanism whereby they could hide behind it and have this plausible deniability to their racism. So
rather than just saying it straight out, we don't want you here.
Exactly. I find that fascinating.
Yeah. I wonder if that's a part of British culture, like colonization in a way almost.
Well, I mean, colonization, it's power really. It's sort of just when you really start thinking about these things, you have to wonder what is power and how old is it really?
As old as time, really.
Exactly. It's been around much longer than we have, and it's sort of made who we are in some ways. And confronting that and that worship of power is in all of us in some ways, and it needs to be tampered or at least controlled in a way which makes it less destructive. And that's kind of what culture and religion tries to do, and it's been figuring out ways of doing for a very long time. And so when we remove one way of controlling that. I mean, getting a bit abstract now, but I mean, a lot of the problems of the 20th century come down to removing the old ways of us controlling our thirst for power, and then it sort of spilling out. And I think that happens, especially in the 20th century.
Yeah, gosh, that's getting very abstract.
Sorry.
No, but it's true. I mean, I think we're living in such an interesting time, right? I mean, when you started creating, just to put it in context, what year was Monga Khan's photo taken?
So his photo was taken in 1916. So when I started sticking them up in all over Australia, it was exactly 100 years since the photograph was taken.
Wow, so 2016. Was that the year Trump was inaugurated, or was that 2016 or 2017? How many years have we been going through it?
It feels like a long time, doesn't it?
It does.
I think it might have been at the end of that year.
Yeah, such an interesting time culturally. So you stuck up the poster of Monga Khan with his turban, and underneath it said Aussie in big letters, and put that all over Australia. And then you use that same technique, right, for other posters as well, with Aussie written down. What did you want people to do when they saw that poster or feel?
Well, I think it obviously it conflicts with what that image that we all have in our head of what a typical Aussie looks like. Moggy Khan has a big moustache, big turban. He looks like a Muslim man, and it looks like an old image. You know that it wasn't taken – it looks like it was taken 100 years ago.
Yeah, it does.
And so it sort of tells the lie to that idea that multiculturalism is just this new thing. It's – I mean, the way we talk about it and think about it is new, but really we're a mix from the very beginning, and people like Moggy Khan have been here for a long time, and so he belonged. Ultimately, like, I can make it much simpler. Like, I think that what I want people to get from that image is that they want to identify with Moggy Khan. They'd like him. They'd rather imagine themselves sort of getting along with him rather than the people who wrote the White Australia policy. I think he is more Aussie than them. And I think that's why people like the image, is that you look at him and go, he looks like a proud guy. I wonder what he was like. I want to be his friend. Like, that's what I get from the image. That's exactly how I felt as soon as I saw it.
Sort of leaps out at you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He's just so beautifully, sounds terrible, manicured even. Like, his moustache is so beautifully put together. You think, great, 100 years ago.
That's the amazing thing about so many of those photos, is that there's this interesting sort of mixture of shame and pride, because they knew why they're having their photo taken, but in those days that might have been one of the only photographs they ever had taken. So, you know, everyone got dressed up for it.
Yeah, and you had to stand very still. Their facial expression is so still. It's almost like a painting, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's the people taking the photographs were portrait photographers, and that follows a tradition of like classical portraiture. So it's they had their photos taken front on the camera, but also side on. And it's the same. That's like the way kings and queens had their
photos taken too.
Yeah.
I was listening to Benjamin Law talk about the Chinese history in Australia too, which is, I think, something that they've been here, like, you know, 200 years since colonization as well, working in the goldfields and all kinds of things. So Chinese history is another part of our story in Australia that sometimes gets swept under the carpet too. What are some other examples of images that you used on that Aussie poster?
Well, there was a couple I used from the Sim Tune family in South Australia, and they were a great find in the archive, because people in South Australia have already heard of Gladys Sim Tune. She was born in Unley in South Australia of Chinese parents, and I found sort of the family's folder in the archive, because they travelled back to China a bunch of times. And so you see the kids growing up in the photographs. They're there as little kids, and then as teenagers, then as adults, because they keep going back to China to buy goods to sell in their emporium. And I thought that was terrific, because most Australians have heard of Gladys Sim Tune, most South Australians, but her sister no one recognised. So I thought, oh, I'll use her sister's image, Dorothy, rather than using the image of Gladys, which people would recognise. And that was terrific, I think, to sort of, I don't know, because taking someone who's already famous and sort of, I wanted to sort of find someone who was less so.
Yeah, and almost tell their story.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I do is not so much, it works on history, but I'm not a historian. I think that's probably a distinction worth making. I mean, I find out as much as I can about it, but ultimately I'm not sticking up the person's whole story, and I'm actually encouraging people on the street to imagine for themselves, because that has a different function to just telling the facts. And that's especially true with the Moggy Khan image, because we published a small book of fictional short stories and poems about Moggy Khan. And it's important that it was fictional, because I think empathy requires your imagination in some ways. And if you're just telling the facts and just saying this is the factual history, that doesn't sort of open up the field to someone being a folk hero or someone being a figure that you really empathize with. So while I'm interested in the actual facts of what happened, I think that trying to create a folk hero is a different task.
Yeah, trying to create him as a myth. There's podcast dog. She likes to make herself known. Yeah, creating a character of folklore like a Ned Kelly, who is a bushranger for us, and there's so much imagery around him. And you're right, there's something really powerful about that.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Empathy is a really big theme, I think, in your work as far as I can see. That message Australians or real Australians say welcome, how did you come to that particular message?
A twist on some of the xenophobic slogans you get, like fuck off or fool is a pretty classic one. And I just thought...
Which is fun to say, actually.
It is. I mean, that's yeah. What I talk about in the book is that like propaganda, like good propaganda is sort of fun and...
Punchy?
And punchy, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it... Yeah, fuck off, we're full. It's sort of it's a little weapon that you once you learn it you can use. And so I thought I want to give the other side a weapon like that and show the xenophobes how it feels to be excluded. And so that's how I came up with Real Australians Say Welcome. But it was inspired by the Australian national anthem because there's a part in the second verse which you never hear because you never get that far in the anthem. And it says, for those who come across the seas with boundless plains to share, with courage, let us all combine to advance Australia fair.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And
that'd be a nice dream.
Well, exactly. It's kind of, I think all national art or a national anthem is an artwork. It's always aspirational. So yeah, that's how I came up with that slogan.
Yeah. What was people's reaction to it?
The project kind of exploded and I really sort of was hoping that it would. But one of the best things about the way people got into it was that they took the slogan and redesigned it because my poster is very sort of plain and forceful, and artists and designers based on a sort of a
the design files?
The design files.
Yeah, which is one of my favorite websites.
Yeah.
Is a huge design blog. Design files, if you're a creative, is just like a wonderful place for artists to share their work. Their writing there is great. And yeah, so it's really, it features creatives from all over Australia, really.
I'd never heard of it. And I mean, well, and my wife, Julie, sort of got in contact when the design files launched this thing. Because the design files said, look, Peter Drew is sticking up 1,000 of these Real Australians Say Welcome posters around the country. We will reshare anyone who redesigns the slogan.
Oh, my gosh.
And, wow. Yeah, which is great. But I hadn't heard of the design files. So Julie calls me up and says, you might want to check your Instagram. And I was busy sticking up posters. And so I was like, oh, go on, just leave me alone. And but sure enough, things were blowing up because everyone wanted to get on the design files. And there were just dozens of these artists and illustrators redesigning the slogan, and it just sort of took over the internet for a little while. That was great.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I liked what you said about how you didn't want your original design to be beautiful.
No.
No, you just wanted it to be strong and say, why was that? Why didn't you want to? Because none of your artwork, I mean, the photos are beautiful, but the other one, you sort of just put the slogan there. You know, it's not kind of beautiful. Like Julie, your wife, is a printmaker and does this incredibly beautiful, colourful, vibrant prints, and that's not your work. Why no. Why not beautiful? Why not
I think
do that kind of thing?
A couple of reasons. I mean, for that one, it was because I made Real Australians Say Welcome as forceful as possible. It sort of it gave other people room to make it beautiful. But also I think that, I don't know, there's just something in design, there'd be some theory around this that I don't have at my fingertips, but by making something as plain as possible, it sort of, it gives seriousness to it in some way. I don't know. I mean, with every design I come up with, I try to make it softer, By just making it plain, it sort of it allows people to, I don't know.
To just read the words, maybe?
Just the words, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess political slogans and are really very simple and straightforward, aren't they? They don't have embellishments all over them.
That's it. Yeah, and I think that gives people room to, you know, they embellish it then when they're thinking about the meaning of it. Whereas if you're trying to sell it by making it beautiful, it sort of it maybe gets in the way of that, or it's you sort of see what the artist or designer is trying to do. You go, oh, you're trying to trick me by making it more beautiful. By being as plain as possible, it seems less suspect in some ways.
Yeah, well, I guess it's like making logos and things too, right? Often they just need to say exactly what you want them to read because you're walking past them too, and I would assume that's like with street art. You're walking past it, people might only see your poster for a fraction, a couple of seconds and keep walking. So you want it to jump out at you.
Absolutely.
And the message is more important.
Absolutely. Yeah. You want it to shout. And especially with Real Australian Say Welcome, I wanted it to shout as loud as possible because it was a parody of that certainty, you know, that I know exactly what a real Australian is and they say welcome. And it's sort of, it's a silly way to think. And I think that sort of the irony of that, it came across most of the time. I think some people perhaps didn't take it that way, but I certainly did.
Yeah. You've occasionally had people come up on the street and yell at you, right? Because your posters are provocative and make them think. Is it ever women?
Yeah, but I mean, very rarely. I mean, it's men are just more confrontational, I think. And I'm quite tall, so I think yeah. that sort of thins out the crowd of who bothers to come up to me. But there's one woman in the book who comes up to me, and that was in Sydney. And that was quite a funny interaction. I've had tons of people come up to me, and I've tried to describe in the book a bit of a spread because there are all kinds of political pathologies and they're not just the angry old white guy.
Yeah, which is my immediate reaction. I just think, F off, mate. That doesn't belong here. You know, that kind of old white guy that's angry. I'm sure you've counted them.
Yeah. I mean, he's in the book a couple of times as well
Various guys,
yeah. But this lady in Sydney, I was on my way home and she thought, and I was fixing up a poster because I could see that I hadn't stuck it up properly enough. And she thought that I was, because I was
in a high-vis vest.
Yeah.
And it was a very well-to-do part of Sydney, right? So yeah. Very posh, not a lot of graffiti anywhere or anything like that.
Exactly. And I get up on this bin, I think it was, and I'm fixing it up. And she starts filming me on her phone and saying, no, you don't. You're not going to take that down, that sort of thing. She thought that I was going to take it down because I looked like I was a worker, like on the street. And rather than say to her politely, listen, this is my poster, I'm just fixing it up, I just thought, you asshole, like just because I look like this, you're assuming that I am just getting rid of this poster.
Like an uneducated person, council worker or someone following the rules, or is that what you mean?
Yeah, or just sort of, no, it was the way that she spoke to me is that by her defending it, she was signalling her virtue over me in some way. And I just thought that, I mean, that section of the book is about class, really, because she was using her poster to assert her moral superiority, also according to her class, because I looked like somebody who was working on the street and wouldn't understand how much, you know, she said to me, this neighborhood's white enough, thank you very much. Like, you know.
Even though I'm assuming she was white as well. Yeah, with faux African beads or something.
Exactly. And I just thought, this, I can't sort of stop this. I can't stop people from using my posters to signal their virtue according to their class. And that irritated me, and I thought that was worth something, worth putting in the book, because the book's really about me sort of realizing in so many ways how these things are much simpler. They're much more complicated than my posters can possibly convey, and just the frustration of realizing that. And so that, I thought that was a good example.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess we're living in a time where the left and the right like to yell at each other, and I think both sides are just as bad in the way that they can treat, particularly extremes,
yeah,
the way they treat people and each other and the pylons online and all of the talk, and obviously issues of immigration and refugees and nationhood, and particularly in Australia with such a short history since colonisation, a long history of Indigenous culture in our country, how we navigate all of that is really complicated. And
It's impossibly complicated. And that doesn't mean don't try. What it does mean, or what I think works, is not having a sense of absolute certainty in the righteousness of your
cause or belief system.
Exactly. Because, you know, be a little more humble than going out into the world thinking that you've got it figured out, because it's always going to be more complicated than even the smartest person in the room and their understanding of it. So, and this, the peace that we find on any issue is always a compromise. It's always a compromise. And so if you go into a negotiation believing that, then you're going to have a much better chance of finding peace. And I think that's something I sort of had to learn, because especially when you're young, you want to find the key that's going to make you invulnerable to the world. And whether that's an ideology or sort of an attachment to your ethnicity, or that desire finds so many different forms of political pathology. And so I was a bit like that, and I think there's a bit of that in my posters as well.
Like not that they say this, but like a moral superiority, like I've got it figured out, know that, or something like that.
Well, at least I think they show like a desire for certainty, especially real Australians say welcome. I mean, I see that it's ironic, but I think there was a part of me at the time that wanted to know that certainly, like that I was right and that I was going to tell others the way it should be.
Yeah. It strikes me too, it comes with a certain privilege, right? The ability to be open-minded and welcoming and, you know, everyone should be treated equally, all of those things, which I believe, but it does come with privilege, because when you've grown up with wealth and a family that supports you and, you know, a good education and even the fact that we have Australian passports and live in this country opens opportunities to us that the majority of the world, frankly, don't experience. Mm-hmm. So of course we can afford to be everyone's welcome, everyone come in, because we've got so much. Mm-hmm. And privilege is a tricky thing, isn't it? Do you find that?
Absolutely. And I think you can sort of put that into concrete terms when it comes to the immigration debate, because I think that if you are at the lower end of the labor market and you can see your job getting taken away quite easily, then that you have perfectly legitimate reasons for being fearful about immigration, which have nothing to do with xenophobia. And then to have someone whose job isn't threatened because they have a much higher income sticking their nose up at you and saying, well, you should just be a little more welcoming, that just essentially being called a racist because you want to protect your job, that's completely infuriating. And in terms of like rhetoric, it's, you know, irresponsible and not helpful. And so I think that, the way that we talk about immigration is once something like racism comes into it, that becomes the way of winning that debate every time, it means the debate falls apart.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of have come to a realization that I think the way forward is just to listen. The
more
you
can help.
Listen. Yeah. I mean, I'm not certain about that either. You know, there is no absolutes, but listening to people from different perspectives. I was really fascinated in the campaign that you did that wasn't quite so successful with Indigenous Australians and their culture. Could you talk a little bit about your experience with those posters that you started making and then what happened?
Yeah, because I did the slogan, Real Australians Say Welcome, I thought, there's something problematic about that as well, because who has the right to say welcome? And it goes back to that line in the anthem, for those that come across the seas, we've boundless plains to share. Really? And how did we acquire those boundless plains? They were just taken because the colonizers were more powerful than the people who had been here for 60,000 years. And so I thought, that's that. So when it gets down to it, Australian identity is this paradox of wanting to be welcoming, but we ourselves were never welcomed. And so the slogan I came up with was the inverse of the original one, which is Real Australians Seek Welcome. And I had a design which incorporated the phrase Aboriginal land and an arrow pointing to the ground. So the poster would show that this, where the poster is placed, is Aboriginal land. And I thought that's not really enough, because what's one of the most interesting things about Aboriginal culture is that it's diverse. You know, there is not one Aboriginal culture. There were, 250 different language groups when the British arrived. And so, and that's an example of multiculturalism, isn't it? And I thought that was an interesting parallel, the multiculturalism of then and the multiculturalism of now. And so I was trying to squeeze all of that into a poster project. And the idea was to make 250 different poster designs for the different language groups. I sort of set about doing this. I had this horrible feeling of anxiety the whole time I was sort of committing to this project, because in the back of my head, there was this voice saying, you're not going to pull this off. It's not possible. And it's too politically fraught. But I pushed ahead and sort of found that it was too difficult. There were various feedback that I got that sort of let me know that it was something, not that what I was saying was wrong, but a lot of it was that if someone else was saying it, someone who was Aboriginal, that would have been, it's more something for them to say.
Yeah. Because the names of their language groups are not yours to share in a way.
But at the same time, I spoke to people that said, yes, do it, who are Aboriginal. And I spoke to people who were Aboriginal that said, stop doing it. And so it's like any political field. There are people who agree and disagree. There's huge pushes now to get people to use Aboriginal place names, because it's really an acknowledgement of country. And that's something that anybody Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal can do when at the beginning of an event or on their Twitter handle. Not Twitter handle, but, you know.
In the bio
section. Exactly.
Yeah.
We acknowledge country, and that's ultimately what the posters were doing. But still, it's this sort of field of culture which is still being negotiated. And I think ultimately there's a difference between a national poster project and your Twitter bio. With Twitter bio is much sort of much smaller, but a huge project in which I'm going out sticking up thousands of posters was too big.
And I mean, it's such a short history since colonization, since all of the events that happened. I don't know if you've read a book called Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe.
I'm halfway through at the moment.
It's really fascinating. It's amazing, right? Yeah. Really interesting. And there's also, I think it's called The Greatest Estate, and that book is recommended in Dark Emu. I'm not written by Bruce Pascoe, but it's also about Australia and how when the British arrived, all the reports suggest that Australia was like a big estate, a gentleman's estate in Britain, and it wasn't by accident. It was by agriculture and a culture of people who knew how to care for the land and grow food and all those sorts of things. But I really feel like the history that we know and are taught is so narrow, and there's just so much more for us to unpack and learn and sort of uncover about our nation's history, Indigenous history. And of course, after all of the events that happened and massacres and all kinds of things, it's not sort of not our story to tell in lots of ways. But it's just complex. I don't know what I'm trying to say. There's layers of shame and resentment and anger and, things to really – I mean, a lot of it was whitewashed, right, history, I feel.
Absolutely. And that's – it's not so much that it's not it, – in a way, it is our history to tell. It's our responsibility to tell that history. But it's sort of – it's so – but it's not any one person's – you know, it's history to tell. It has to be sort of a collaboration. And you're right. It has been whitewashed because it's too difficult to face. I don't think it's an Australian problem. It's a human problem of what it means to worship power in a way. I mean, because there's an element of that in every nation's history and in every person's history. It points at which they went, I'm doing this because I want it and I don't care whether it's wrong or right. Yeah. And so to confront that in, you know, that exists deep down inside of us, it's a hard thing, and try to reconcile that with this image that we have, especially in Australia, of being happy simpletons.
Yeah, kind of like larrikins, and we're all for the underdog, you know, and we kind of don't like tall poppy, in that tall poppy syndrome. So we like to kind of be scrappy and all of that kind of thing, and up and coming, and you were young, and, you know, all of those sorts of things. Yeah, it's a funny juxtaposition. It doesn't. And then you think that kind of must come from the fact that a lot of our ancestry, my ancestors were convicts, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, she was a prostitute that came at 14 from Britain and stole a watch or something.
Oh, really? You know? I was about to say, was that really your?
Definitely. And she met a cattle rustler on the ship. And they hustled their way in on that. That was the first fleet. They hustled their way in. They must have been really charming or something, because they fell in love and then kind of hustled to get themselves a bit of land when they finally were done their sentence, and then kind of went from there and had lots of kids, and then ended up owning property. And I think she had an affair with a wealthy man and took off with him. And, you know, like, there's just lots of.
It's a great story.
Yeah, so interesting. But like, so many people in our, you know, country have history like that. And so you can see why that narrative of the underdog and the larrikin and the simpleton kind of comes, because a lot of the people, you know, our ancestry is from convicts who were also living in poverty and had no choice, but kind of were forced to come here. So
no, and I,
anti-authoritarian, you know, all that stuff.
I love all of that. And I think that we should keep that and add to it, because I think that the reason why there's pushback against this feeling of shame that we're dealing with when we talk about these big, deep, dark secrets is that people think that, well, I don't want to lose the sense of pride I have in who I am. And I think that's not necessary. What we have waiting in front of us is a national identity which is bigger and broader, more complex and interesting, which we can, which we have if we just sort of apply ourselves to the truth. And I think that that story you just told me is incredible, and there's no part of that which gets erased by opening up to the rest of Australia's history, like especially what we're talking about with colonisation.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that, because it strikes me that you're talking about Australia, but you're also talking about your own story, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because once you hit on the truth of something, the fear is once people find out the truth, once they know my deep dark shame, everything will be ruined, my life will be ruined. And often the inverse, actually always really, the inverse is true, that if you can work through all of that pain, you end up shining a light, you grow more as a person, you learn more about others. Everyone starts to tell you their shame and their things that are terrible that they've done. And once you can do that, you can move forward and kind of incredible things can happen.
Well, that's the hope. I mean, that's what I started off hinting at, things like redemption and, you know, you said reconciliation. These are old spiritual concepts, and the idea is that they are infinite, you know, that there is no limit to what can be forgiven in a way. And you've sort of got to believe that, because there's certainly no limit to how bad people can be. And so, I mean, to bring it back home, that's what I hoped would happen with writing this book and my family, is that my parents didn't do anything that bad, you know, but still they were holding on to this secret. And I wanted to let them know that, look, I know about it and you don't need to keep it a secret. In fact, I wish you didn't. And I understood that they were uncomfortable about the book being out there, but the sky didn't fall in, you know.
No.
And other people, and what other people think about us as a family doesn't matter. If we all love each other, then the outside world sort of doesn't matter at all. And so that was my hope. And things between us are good, and I'm very glad that I didn't sort of just keep holding on to things for no reason.
Yeah, or I think sometimes everything can be boiled down to love or fear, right?
Yeah, broadly. I mean, yeah, I think it does help to simplify. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with my posters, is simplify things to make them digestible in some ways. And love and fear, yeah, a dichotomy, love and fear, love and hate, good and evil, are these things sort of make it understandable. And, you know, then you look at it closer and it's sort of, there's infinite complexity within that. But yeah.
And that's life, right?
That's life, yeah.
Yeah. There's a beautiful quote in your book, and you talk beautifully about Julie's family and what she's taught you. She's Italian, is that right?
Yeah, her mum's Italian, yeah.
Yeah, and she's sort of got this big, vibrant family that's loud and full of love and noise and food and all of that stuff. And I could totally relate to that. I grew up in a family that was very much pass the butter and what do you think about the political landscape at this current moment, you know? And I just am not like that. Part of my heritage is Italian as well. And so I've always been kind of loud and emotional and want to talk about everything all of the time. And my husband's family is very loud and they make fun of each other all the time. And in my family, you wouldn't make fun of anyone because someone would end up storming off in a huff. But they just tease each other and have stupid jokes. And there's this joy that comes from that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I loved that quote. There's a lecturer that you worked with called John. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And he says in the book, when I fell apart emotionally, I realized that loving acts are all that matter.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that was, I mean, John was a lecturer that I found while I was in uni. And, you know, I think everyone, if you're lucky, you find one teacher in your life who just is overflowing with inspiration. Like, they're just a great teacher. And but I think that, like, he understood European philosophy in an amazing way, but deep underneath it all was just this sort of belief in love as being something that was crucially important. And I thought that was, and it's funny sometimes how you can miss things like that. Like, he said that to me, and that was, it was sort of embedded in everything that he said, but it was sort of so simple. And I this sort of arrogant person who thought I had the answers to things, but really love holding the whole world together is there's a lot of truth to that. And it's sort of, it's embedded in everyday life, in the smallest things and the biggest things.
Yeah, I love that. And that to me is the biggest learning I took from your book.
That's great. I'm really glad, because that was sort of what I writing the book is difficult. And I sort of, you know, because you get into the weeds, and I wrote the book to figure myself out in a lot of ways. And that sort of reliance on love and realizing that I had to sort of surrender to it in some ways. That's something I've just discovered in my life in moments. And I knew that had to be in the book, that sort of the importance of love.
Yeah. What has Julie taught you about creativity and love?
Oh, so much. I mean, that's what I want to write about next in some ways, because, yeah, that's a big one. And I can explain this, and it just gets a little bit too intellectual, really. I mean, which is not what you really want from a question like that.
That's all right. Go for it. We'll just see what happens.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think when I was growing up, especially when I came out of high school and went into uni, I was very rational, and I started studying things at university that were about science and reason and empiricism and these sort of, you know, these words that are all about slicing up the world into blocks and turning the world into sort of a play of objects in a way. And the world isn't just built of objects. It's also built of processes and things that are more
intangible
and difficult to quantify. And so me sort of surrendering to love in a broader sense, not just to Julie, was really just learning to sort of love your own sort of powerlessness in the face of the world, really, because the world is much, much bigger than you are, and you're never really going to be able to control very much of it. And so you have to love the world in some ways. It's much better than, and that's what I was like when I was younger, is there was a part of me which actually hated the world. And I think that's a trap that young people can fall into quite easily. And at some point, if you're lucky, and if you meet somebody who's kind and makes you feel like you can trust them, then you learn to just put that aside and surrender to love.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. It's so funny, because it strikes me as you're not someone that would say that, surrender to love.
It's hard for me to say.
Yeah, but because
it makes you vulnerable, and I have difficulty, because it's not something that I, it's not where I'm at in everyday life all the time. So, but it's what I've found. It's what I've found works. So, I've got to say it. Yeah.
Someone who's it's awesome to hear, because I think there's particularly, and this is a generalization, but I sense there's a lot of young men particularly who are angry at the world.
Absolutely.
And I mean, women too, for lots of reasons as well, but men in particular, there's this sort of that beautiful way that you talked about understanding your powerlessness in some ways in the face of the universe and the world and our place in it. I think men, young men in particular, seem to be struggling hugely with their place in the world and the notion of who they are and how to deal with all that anger and where to put it. And hearing someone like you, who I can tell when I read the book, is a very logical, deep thinking, analytical kind of, yeah, material world in blocks sort of person,
yep,
academic, to come to that realization after all of that writing and thinking. Yeah, congratulations. Well done. It's bloody hard. Brené Brown, who I think you should go and read now and watch some stuff about her. She does a lot. She studies vulnerability and shame. That's her wheelhouse. She's an academic as well and a lecturer, and just accidentally became famous from doing this talk on vulnerability. And it's really powerful. And she was just like terrified about opening herself up to who and sharing these deep, dark sort of secrets about herself. And it's turned out to be the best thing she ever did.
Sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, that wisdom is, as soon as you sort of open yourself up to it, you see it embedded within culture, within all sort of spiritualities. It's there just sort of waiting for people to find it. But it's very it's difficult stuff to get across and difficult stuff to accept. So, yeah, and I think you're absolutely right about young men having that difficulty. And I was lucky enough to just have a few people around me that helped me, help me open up to it. And I could have quite easily have been lost. And people do get completely lost and they go over the edge of the cliff in one way or another. If I can hope my book does anything, is that it can help help people steer themselves away from that a little bit.
Yeah, I hope so too. I definitely recommend going to read Post of Voy, particularly, well, I think everyone gets a lot out of it, but particularly if you have a young man in your life or you are a young man or, I really think that there's a lot of wisdom to be gained. So thank you so much for writing it, because it seems to me like it would have been a very hard thing to do.
Thanks a lot. It was difficult, but it was also fun. I mean, it was something that I needed to do. So yeah,
thank you. Okay, last question before we finish. How do you write a book? Like, how do you actually physically, what do you do in your day? What does your day look like to do that?
It's a great question. Because I'd never done this before and it's different to what I normally do. The first half I found came out very quickly and easily, it was in about 3 months, and I would wake up as early as I could, have a light breakfast and write until midday-ish, and then after that I just sort of would feel worn out and maybe would edit a bit. And the second half of the book I wrote it almost the inverse, like I wrote it at night at the end of the day, and that was a lot harder because I was trying to resolve all the things that I had sort of brought up in the first half. It was strange. It was a bit sort of, it was a bit light and dark in a way, the two halves of the book. But you have to focus. I had a computer set up in the front room and I just have to sort of nest myself in there a little bit. I saw this great video of Roald Dahl when his writing habits, he had a shed out in the backyard. He had a little sort of tray table. He'd get sort of set up with, I think he smoked cigarettes and he'd have his cup of tea and just sort of nest in and really focus. You just sort of have to block everything else out. And I found that was true for me too.
Yeah, get really cozy in there. Yeah. I've seen that. It's almost like a reclining chair, yep, right? And you kind of have to surrender to all the neuroses and thoughts and get lost in it.
Well, that's it. Like, it's, you can have some idea of what you're about to write, but sometimes you sit down and you're like, I've got no idea what's coming next. And you really need to just sort of settle in and let the words and ideas and images sort of bubble up, and then you start listening in a way. You go, oh, I can hear, okay, I know what's coming next, and it starts to roll out.
Yeah. Did you ever feel that sense of flow where you're not really going tap, tap, tap? it's coming from somewhere else.
Oh, absolutely. Like whole chapters just rolled out. And it's frustrating when you sort of then maybe the next day you go, oh, great, well, that was easy. We'll sit down and do that again. And it's just like there's nothing there. And you've sort of just got to forgive yourself when it's like that. And just loosen up. You can't sort of force it. Yeah.
So you have to just turn up.
No, that is the best advice. Is to show up and just sit in front of the screen, looking at the words. But if you go, I'll go away and do something else. It's sort of that rarely leads to you writing more. Although in the shower as well, when you're like relaxing at the end of the day, that's, you know, everyone's had that sort of, that's when the idea comes, when you're completely relaxed. It helps.
Yeah, I think Will Anderson said to me he's like leapt out of the shower and scribbled something on a piece of paper and then got back in and kept washing his hair. Yeah, it's funny like that, or driving. I think Roald Dahl, I read, had a book that he kept with him when he went everywhere, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory happened because he was driving and it popped into his head. He pulled over and wrote A Boy Who Lives in a Chocolate Factory on a little scrap of paper, and came back to that years later and then wrote, you know, this famous book. It's, yeah, you can't underestimate your ideas, right?
No, that's right. They're little seeds. Like sometimes they just pop into your head and you have a feeling attached to it. And that's all my poster projects came to me in the same way of it. Just there was just some little nugget, and then it just sort of explodes out. And you just got to pay attention to your own thoughts and write those things down.
Yeah, and I think because immediately I got fearful because I thought, oh, I've just had so many ideas and not ever written them down. And that's the other part of it, isn't it? That there's just always another idea. There will be.
Yeah. You can't beat yourself up about the stuff that you've lost, and things come back around as well. Sometimes you go, you know, you remember the thing that you thought you lost.
Yeah. I like that. All right. Thank you so much, Peter Drew. Oh, I'll put a link to where you can buy your book, Poster Boy, and we can go and follow you on Instagram. Is it at Peter Drew Arts?
Yep.
Yeah. That's it. On Instagram and Twitter as well.
I'm on there as well.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast called Just Make the Thing with me, Claire Tonti, and this week with Peter Drew. You can find his book, Poster Boy, at all good bookstores, and I so recommend you do. I grabbed it on my Kindle and read it in a day. It was a great read. You can also find more about Peter at Peter Drew Arts. He's also got a website where you can see all of his glorious posters, and I really recommend going to having a look at those, particularly the image of Monga Khan. It just kind of jumps out at you. You might even see some of his posters around if you're in Australia or America, because he ventured over there recently into LA as well to put up some of his street art. Also go and follow Julie White, his partner, who is a print artist. Oh, mate, her scarves are delightful. And I've also bought a print of hers for our room because it's really cool, bright and vibrant and fun. So go over there and follow her too. For more shows just like this one, you can scroll back through the feed. I've got interviews with Claire Bowditch, with writer Jamila Risby, with comedian Will Anderson, with Silver Collar and Luke McGregor from Rosehaven and comedy around the traps in Australia. I've also got wholehearted chats with my wonderful friend Chanel Luchev, where we discuss how hard it is to be creative and all the things in between. Okay, you can follow the show at Just Make the Thing on Instagram, and you can follow me at Claire Tonti on Instagram. You can email the show at justmakethethingpod@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you, suggestions for guests or comments or things that you're making. I would love to hear from you. All right, that's it from me. Thanks as always to Raw Collings for editing this episode. Till next week, surrender to love, guys. What I got from this episode, surrender to love. Okay, bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.